Well, good morning, members. Called meeting to order. We're going to do a couple of things fairly quickly today, I hope, because we have a lot on our agenda. One of the things we need to do is to make an informal recommendation to the bonding committee about what we would propose if to put in a bonding bill this year, recognizing that this is not the year when we do major bonding, but it is traditionally a year that we do some bonding. So what the consensus I felt around the room, and as people talked about it, one of the things we want to do is maintenance, deferred maintenance, do the things that are sitting on the back burner, but also things that could get going right away, that are shovel ready. And so I asked the Department of Natural Resources if they would draw up a list of things like that. Remember, we have passed out maintenance lists for parks and trails, and both parks and trails, and those lists have been passed out, but they were not necessarily things that could go on the ground this summer. So in your packet, you will find something from Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer, which lists those things that they feel are ready to go. So if you just want to take a look at that list, and if he comes in here, he is here. I'm sorry. Wonderful. Welcome up. Welcome. I missed seeing you right. You were right behind Representative Torkelson, and I didn't see you. Instead of my explaining this, if you would want to give a few words about this and see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Director Bob Myers, Department of Natural Resources. The memo you have in front of you is a response to the question that Representative Gagnon has asked the department on what type of project. Is it deferred maintenance, asset preservation type project the department has that would be ready to go this year? And you can see, I think the important thing is the last paragraph under the box there. It says, providing funding for maintenance projects like these would employ many small contractors for multiple trades throughout the state. We're in the process of also developing a similar list for 10 and 11. But these are the type of projects that, once the funding was received, that we would be able to bid pretty quickly. I don't want to say immediately. It'll take a little bit of time to bid. But you can see the examples, renovations of buildings for energy efficiency, installing renewable energy, mechanical and electrical systems, that some of the items we've talked about in our budget presentations in parks and in our facilities. Locations would include Glenwood, State Park, Glenwood, Lake Bronson, William O'Brien, Fort Snelling, Split Rock, Itasca, Lake Maria, Pettigooch, McCarthy Beach, and also evaluating and upgrading our offices in Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Warner Road, New Ulm, and Brainerd. We do have a number of roofs that need to be replaced that could be done immediately. State Park facilities in William O'Brien, Whitewater, Fort Snelling again, Split Rock, Temperance, and Itasca, and also several office locations. You can see Park Rapids, New Ulm, the Mille Lacs Lake Wildlife Management Area facility, and Peterson Hatchery. Well and water treatment systems that need to be replaced or work to improve. We do have a number of water treatment facilities at our larger parks, so you can see that those things do need to be maintained and upgraded. Lake Mariah or Itasca, Gooseberry Falls, Moose Lake, Savannah Portage, Pettigooch, Beaver Creek, Fort Snelling, Whitewater, Flandreau, Meyer Big Island, and Sakata. Road resurfacing, these are simple projects that can take place as soon as we could identify a contractor in most cases. These are the roads within the state parks at Lake Mariah, Banning, Crow Wing, Sudan Mines, Beaver Creek, Father Hennepin, Forestville Mystery Cave, Blue Mounds, and Camden. Major culvert replacement and erosion control, the Root River would be a focus, as well as the Munger Trail and the Sakata Trail in southern Minnesota. Number of water access sites that could be rehabilitated on our larger lakes, Lake Bemidji, Lower Hay Lake, Lake Minnewaska, 10 Mile Lake, the Mississippi River at Lake City, O'Dowd, and Lake Hendrick. trail resurfacing and widening. We could do 90 miles of trail resurfacing and widening this season. It's about $100,000 a mile. It is rather expensive, but this is something we've been talking about for several years within our capital investment asset preservation deferred maintenance project. And I think you've seen pictures of the cracks, the weeds, the vegetation coming through the trail system. This work would be done immediately. And then bridge rehab or repair on the state trails as well, the Root River, Munger, and Sakata, Heartland Trail. These activities would be done before the snow flies in most cases by the end of this calendar year.
Questions by members? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, just maybe a little bit of detail on bidding or how much work is done by state employees and how much is done with local contractors and how that process works.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm going to bring up Kath Alstup from our Management Resources Division. She can talk a little bit about how we can get this set up to go and then that distribution of work that would take place.
Welcome to the committee.
Members, my name is Kath Alska. I'm the facility manager for the Department of Natural Resources. And Madam Chairman and Representative Hansen, to your question, we do have a group of architects and civil engineers within DNR that do 80% of the design work, have traditionally done 80% of the design work. All of the projects are bid out to contractors. I think depending on the amount here of bonding we would get, we may also hire consulting architects and engineers to be able to handle this volume of work in a short time.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and a follow-up, so the internal design or the engineers, when would they start work? Upon passage?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is correct. We do a lot of trail work, so for that we do have designs for the bituminous, and generally what we do is we grind up the existing bituminous surface, and then that forms a good base. It also keeps all that from the landfill, and then we put a bituminous overlay. So the design would be ready relatively quickly. On the trails, we of course have to wait until we get rid of some of the white stuff out there in order to be able to do the trail, but we'd be ready to go.
Any other questions from members? Well, without objection, I will, by letter, forward this list to the bonding committee. They've asked just for a letter from the chair, and without objection, I will do that. Thank you so much, for preparing that, because I know it took some real time from DNR, and I appreciate their doing it in this manner. One of the things that we did not have complete information on that was a bondable project that was actually in our bonding bill last year and was not funded because finance was unable to let the bonds as we had written it in the bonding bill, was a landfill project, and I believe that PCA might have some new information on that for us. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, my name is Lyle Mueller. I'm the finance manager from the MCPA.
My name is Jeff Lewis. I manage the Cold Landfill Program.
Madam Chair, early in the session we were here and we talked fairly briefly as part of the testimony for Representative Bunn's bill. At that point, we touched on the funding for the closed landfill program. There was a report that we had issued. I think we also need to be clear that a request for any bonding is not part of our budget request this year. In the course of preparing that report, I think we've made it clear that we are in a good position to start the Washington County project this year. It is scheduled to go out to bid and potentially be let in fiscal 9, and a large portion of the work would start in fiscal 10. That would mean that during the next session in the regular bonding cycle, we would be back with our major bonding request.
With the project you're planning on letting, is it with a triple liner?
Madam Chair, I'll let Jeff answer.
Madam Chair, yes, the project is scheduled to be advertised for bid on the 28th, I think, of March. It'll be let on April 25th, I think. It is designed with a triple liner to meet the requirements of the language that was passed last year.
Okay. When you were here before, we were looking at this that you had written about the landfill program. And the question to you was on page 17, where it said we were looking at options of how to fund your landfill and your Superfund program because you did not have enough money to do it. So then the question was, option four said, this is comes the closest of the options to allocating sufficient resources from the remediation fund to cover the funding gap for Superfund MRLA landfill cleanup and operation and maintenance. And the question was, if it was complete, I mean, if we actually had a proposal, if you had a proposal that actually worked, what would it look like? And that was what I was hoping you had with you when you came this morning.
Madam Chair, we do not have an option that introduces a specific new revenue source into the environmental fund. I think the option that comes closer to lining up with the governor's budget and what we had prepared as part of the governor's budget backs up to option number three, which speaks to looking to user finance geo bonds with the debt service being paid from the environmental fund, having to make whatever necessary adjustments in the timing. We're not talking about significant adjustments in the timing. And also to be clear as to what the assumptions are or the scenario that we're trying to lay out at the time that we're talking about the finance. For example, under option three, you'll still see that we were talking about two of the sites on the project list that currently are not bond eligible. Those two sites together represent $60 million in construction. And if those two projects needed to be funded from the resources in the remediation fund, we're identifying having about $5 million available a year for closed landfill construction. Clearly that would spread that out over a 12-year time frame. On the other hand, if circumstances change and those two sites can be the ownership of those sites changes, they become publicly owned, they do become bond eligible, then that represents a fairly different scenario. That means the resources in the remediation fund could in fact be allocated differently, and it would close that gap that we're identifying as existing and continuing to exist for the closed lands, so O&M and the Superfund. So it really depends on the scenario and the assumptions that you lay out.
Okay. But that wasn't the question that I asked. And the question I had asked was not an option three, because you're lengthening the time horizon. In other words, procrastinating and having some future generation pay for this. We were going to option... The question I had asked was about option four. And I understand it's not the government's recommendation, but we wanted the information because you in your own words said this option comes closest to allocating sufficient resources. So one of the problems with taking money from the Environment Fund right now is when we look at it, we see that there'd be a shortfall there. So to add to the shortfall by putting on a bonding obligation then invites another cut to your agency. So if we're going to do that, we'll have to have that proposed cut too. So it apparently you don't have this information right now, but if you would give it to us in writing, say within the next couple days, it would be very helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But while you're up here, let me... Did you all bring some spreadsheets for members this morning?
Madam Chair, yes. I think they have been distributed.
Have they been distributed? Okay. They've been distributed then. Members, thank you all for coming. Members, you will see in your packet, we had asked PCA... To do their budget as a results-based budget, and they have provided that for us, and you'll see that in your package. It looks like this, and then there is apparently a new spreadsheet that I didn't see in my packet, but I'm sure it must be in yours. I was thinking of that. It's not here. The numbers I'm telling you. They're still working on that. All right. We will get it in your packets then on Tuesday. There's also a spreadsheet that we saw yesterday, but it was for the years 8 and 9. It wasn't for the ones years we're working on. They will have that. That's right. I was just reminded of that. We will have that for the coming 2 years where they don't have the information yet, but they said they'll be able to get it done by Friday, and we will put it in your packets on Tuesday. Probably too much information in here to digest right away to ask questions, so we will have another opportunity, but I wanted you to have the information as soon as you got it. And... with that, I think we will continue with DNR's budget presentation. Oh, Representative Hansen.
I'm sure I had a follow-up question just on the bonding.
Absolutely.
I know we had talked about DNR's deferred maintenance, and I think during, we had a number of presentations on new trails and new acquisitions.
Yes, we have.
But I think there was some discussion in the regional park system about deferred maintenance as well, and I was just wondering, had those folks provided any detailed numbers or analysis on their deferred maintenance needs in that system?
I don't have a list, but if they would like to provide one, we could certainly bring it to the committee.
I don't know if there's anyone in the audience from the regional park system, or maybe we can follow up with them since they're not here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lowy.
Madam Chair, just before our friends from the PCA leave, earlier in your, when they came originally, we had some questions for them, and I had some questions regards to site in Oakdale, and I had a list of about 3-4 questions, and maybe they could bring that back. I've never seen answers, or I see them out in the crowd, so maybe they could
get those to me sometime. That would really be nice.
Well, see how kind DNR was to get up. We can ask CPA to... I think they didn't want to ask answer the questions that you had, so let's ask CPA if they come up and answer those questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was it was a rather specific site, so I was a little uncomfortable bringing them up, but it was on Highway 5 in Oakdale. There was at one time it was a 3M site, and I had a list of about 3-4 questions, and I thought it's been about 3 weeks or maybe more, maybe 4 or 5 weeks. So I just kind of surprised that I didn't see an answer.
Why didn't you just re-ask the questions and see if make sure they have them and make sure we get them to you? Would you want to re-ask them, or do you have the answers for him?
My name is Kathy Faith. I'm the Division Director for the Remediation Division at the Pollution Control Agency, and we have prepared the responses to the questions, and staff are trying to set up a meeting with you to sit down and go through the answers.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My schedule is usually pretty open, so I'm kind of surprised that I haven't had a, for something like that, I could probably open it up. So I don't imagine that they've tried very hard to set up a meeting is kind of what I'm saying.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Would you also share those responses with us, and we will pass them out to all the committee members?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
And thank you for DNR for taking a short break there. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, again, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me David Epperly, Division Director for the Division of Forestry, to continue our discussion with the forestry budget. On Tuesday, we left off. Actually, we're kind of keeping the timber industry in business with these spreadsheets, but we're doing the best we can. You have a new version of the spreadsheet today that just has forestry, enforcement, and operations support, and then at the end, I'm going to get you a whole compiled copy of everything, and hopefully it'll be 3-hole punch that you can put in your book and to have the whole updated set to contain with you. We left off. Now the sheet we're going to be working on today says final 3.12.09 up in the upper right hand corner. So forestry is on page 1. We ended the day talking about the forest management investment account and the reductions that need to take place in that account, which also has the $2 million change item per year for new money to help offset those reductions and impacts. I don't know if members have any other questions on that proposal, or if you want me to review that rather quickly again, or if you want to move forward.
Representative Self. And thank you, Ms. Chair and Mr. Meyer. I did have a question toward the end of the last session that we had, and it was regarding the $2 million change item. I think you had said that there was a $5 million reduction proposed for 2010, and then a $6.5 million for 2011. I might be right on that. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I'm wondering then, so then the $2 million change item would be subtracted from that, so then that the proposed reduction would only be 3 and 4.5. Would that be accurate?
Madam Chair, partially. Members, the fact sheet that we were talking about, it says forest management activities on the top of it, and it does offset the reduction. The forest management investment account is an account, as we mentioned, that was established that captures most of the revenues from timber management, timber sales into that account, which are used for forestry-related activities. Again, it's more like a revolving fund, so to speak. That account, because of the timber industry and the projections and the forecasting of it, is in the red right now. We've already unallotted $5 million this fiscal year, and we need to unallot, as you mentioned, $5 million in 10 and $6.1 million in 11. So the governor's recommendations for those $2 million per year will reduce those impacts, but this is one-time spending, so it doesn't carry forward. And as I had mentioned, the initial reductions have a potential impact of reducing the division's workforce by 76 FTEs. If you offset that with the $2 million per year, it will allow us to retain 25 FTEs, so the net reduction for the biennium would be roughly 50 or 51 FTEs that we're hoping to manage as much as possible through attrition and vacancy management, but there will be some impact. We're trying to figure out what that is. There's another piece of this puzzle. the forest, the heritage enhancement dollars for the native plant communities work we'll be talking about here shortly, that also will provide some allowance to help us retain some of that workforce as well.
And then the other part of that question was then, you want to have an additional 25 FTEs because you're down 76, and what will those FTEs be doing? What type of work will they be doing, and what kind of jobs are those, and are they ongoing?
Madam Chair, Representative, those FTEs would be working on what we consider our core work. I don't want to get that confused with the core work or core support. But what I mean is that we will be looking at having those FTEs work on the forest management activities that help us generate the revenues for the forest management investment account. And that's a very important element, and we will be working to work with our vacancies and things like that so that we can continue to support that kind of work.
And could you just explain just slightly what you mean by forest management activities? What will these people actually be doing that you want to put on board?
Madam Chair, Representative, that would mainly be those kinds of activities that would support our timber sale program, setting up the timber sales and doing that kind of work that will ultimately lead to the generation of revenue.
If you'd like to continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to move on to the next change item here. You can see there's several other building blocks that we discussed, road and bridge maintenance and repair. You can see the outcomes there. Forest lands re-inventoried, and our expected outcomes is to inventory at least 60,000 acres each year. And then also the acres of state administrator land approved for forest certification. And we need to maintain that. That brings us to the next change item, the forest management heritage enhancement change item. I'll have Director Epperly discuss that, and I'll call your attention to the fact that you have in your packet with the same title.
Madam Chair, part of our state asset management program and one of the tools that we are depending on is our ecological classification system. And the ecological classification system and program helps us, it's a tool that helps us identify native plant communities, which are an indicator of the capability of a site, and it's descriptive of what that site, what that land is actually in both productivity and what it is and what it produces. And the reason why that is important is if we are looking to set our objectives, whether those objectives would be for timber or wildlife habitat maintenance, we can better identify those sites where we can work and where we can apply our resources to get the most, if you will, out of our limited fiscal dollars, and we can apply the work to the ground and meet our objectives as quickly as possible. So this tool is very helpful in us determining where we should work, what kind of work we should be doing, and how we can meet our objectives. And it's an important tool. And so the change item that Commissioner Meyer referred to it provides us a better opportunity to map these native plant communities on the ground and identify that acreage on a continuous process that helps us do our work more effectively.
Madam Chair, just real specifically, what we're talking about would be $950,000 each year from the Heritage Enhancement Account. $600,000 of that would be used for the Ecological Classification System program, and $350,000 would be used for invasive species management. Specifically, you can see on the first page there, partnering with the Department of Agriculture to meet the management detection trapping needs in the state as federal program dollars are declining. Develop a risk rating system for terrestrial invasive species, and also develop and implement silviculture guidelines for emerald ash borer and gypsy moth for land ownerships across the state, and also to control terrestrial invasive species found in critical habitats and or along leading edges of invasive species populations. This is a very important piece of the silvicultural activities of the division, and one that will allow us to meet our goals and objectives, and also to maintain our workforce as much as possible. If there's no other questions, Madam Chair, we're going to briefly talk about the cooperative forest management objective and then go on to program support.
Madam Chair, our cooperative forest management program supports the efforts of private landowners and communities to maintain and enhance their forest resources. The supporting programs are related to private forest management programs and urban and forestry, urban and community forestry programs. The acres of some of the examples and targets that we shoot for in private land management is the number and acres of stewardship plans that we can put together for private landowners. The plans are completed by DNR personnel and our partners, such as within the Soil and Water Conservation District, industrial foresters, and private consultants. The goal or the target is to complete 125,000 acres of forest stewardship plans by the DNR personnel and our partners. Approximately 1.6 million acres of family forests already have stewardship plans, and the long-term goal is to write plans for 2.3 million acres across the state. Private land ownership represents approximately 40% of our forested land, and that component to the overall forest health and capability is very important to the entire system, the entire landscape. Our urban and community forest program, some of the targets that we look at, we have a number of tree inspectors and a number of communities with tree inspectors. We'd like to increase the number of tree inspectors from 800 to 875, and the number of communities with tree inspectors from 475 to 510. The number of forest pest first detectors, increase that number from 180 to more than 300. A primary goal of the program is to build the capacity in local governments in all parts of the state to help manage their tree resources and the contribution to the detection and management of invasive pests. This is especially important in the detection of emerald ash borer and gypsy moth and other pests that plague our urban forests.
Can you break down the dollars between a private forest management and the urban and community forest? Do you have that with you, or could you just give it to us?
Madam Chair, we'll provide that in our comments, our summary document to the committee.
I mean,
I guess we do have that information available.
Madam Chair, for the 2010-2011 biennium, we're looking at about $1 million of general funds for private land forest management, $112,000 from special revenue, and about $8,560,000 for that would be supplied through federal programs dollar support. Community and urban forestry, we have about $700,000 through federal support plans for a total of $10,372,000.
Okay, so that would only, so the urban and community forestry is only federal dollars?
Madam Chair, for the next biennium, that's true.
So the general fund dollars all go to the private forest management?
Madam Chair, that's true, yes. Yeah.
Any other questions from members?
Madam Chair, then continuing on to our core program support, within our core program support, we have a number of supporting programs. The first in your spreadsheet is the Forest Nursery. There is a change item related to the nursery program. I believe you have that in your packets, Madam Chair. It's entitled the Forest Productivity for the Future, and this is a $250,000 change item that talks about the feasibility study for the formation and financing of a state-of-the-art research and seedling production facility. The major program elements that the study would assess would be the public-private partnership for nursery research, large-scale production of containerized seedlings for use in managing Minnesota forests, lands, and the evaluation and development of state-of-the-art harvest equipment. This is important because the demand for high-quality seedlings for conservation purposes and sustaining the state's forests already exceeds the state's current seedling production capacity, and the demand is increasing sharply. The role of forests in mitigating the effects of climate change by sequestering carbon and supplying biomass to help replace fossil fuels is widely recognized and is part of the state's goal to reduce carbon emissions. There are a number of recommendations that came forward from the Climate Change Advisory Group and others, and that it was recommended to increase stocking on the land and increase the planting of trees to help offset some of those things. There's also a need to develop the appropriate equipment to be used to harvest biomass economically and to be able to do that effectively, which it would also be a benefit to help manage our forests. And currently, we believe that the Minnesota nurseries lack the research support and investment capital for upgrades needed to keep pace with the increasing demand. And so,
say that again.
I said we believe that the Minnesota nurseries lack the research support and investment capital for upgrades needed to keep pace with current demand.
So this is to support our nursery industry. That's what essentially this money is for.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Epperly, I could certainly take difference with your last statement. I can think of two examples of the Bailey family and the Bachman family that both have million-dollar chairs, if I'm not mistaken, at the University of Minnesota for exactly what you're talking about. To say those two companies don't lack the financial wherewithal and the rest of the industry, we have a horticulture research institute that many of us have endowments in that is phenomenally huge, that's doing a lot of what you're exactly talking about. Madam Chair, I think this just leads to exactly why I have a bill that Representative Dill, Representative Hamilton, Representative Hortman are on to study why is the DNR in the nursery seedling business. They're not in the logging business. They're not operating paper mills. People are losing their shirt in these businesses today, and I believe that the DNR has been over the last 5 years also, Madam Chair. They're responsible to do an annual report every year to the legislature up at the library. The last two reports are not there yet. I think they're forthcoming. The three before it are very troubling. And I look forward to hearing this issue in Representative Dill's committee, but I think all the members need to know here, we're dealing with a $6 billion potential shortfall. We have to make sure that our government is acting responsible, and especially within the laws that are in these red books. Mr. Epperly, are you aware of Statute 89.06 and what it requires of the DNR nurseries?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes.
Okay, Madam Chair, Mr. Epperly, in line F of 89.06, it says, an economic analysis of surcharges and user fees that would make the nursery and tree improvement program self-supporting. Do you understand that to mean that the nursery are supposed to break even?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, that's the understanding.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I don't want to take any more of the committee's time, but I look forward to the discussion because I think clearly we're not meeting the intent of the law at all, and we have to evaluate what we've got going on with this program. The intent is well meant, but it's clear that we are not supposed to be subsidizing the industry at the expense. We are clearly selling seedlings out of the nursery for less than what our costs are. That's against the law. And we've been doing it for a number of years, and this needs to be brought forward. And I commend Chair Dill for bringing it forward in this committee. We had all these people yesterday storm in our offices about how unfair this is. This is not fair to the 5 million Minnesotans that expect our government to act responsibly. And, Madam Chair, I'm going to let it go at that, but I've been very frustrated with this issue, as you know, for a number of years. But I'm glad we're finally bringing it forward.
Madam Chair, by the statement that I read from the change item, I meant no disrespect to any of the industries that provide these services. And indeed, it's true, the private sector does have access to a number of these research facilities. I think the change item is reflective of the urgency on some of the things for the demand and for the kinds of things that are troubling us right now related to the economy, and how we can provide these kinds of seedlings even in times like this, when we know that the demand and the changes, particularly with climate change, may help us. And so the idea of the study would be to look at the best of what both the public sector and the private sector have to offer, and that was the intent of the feasibility study. So it meant no disrespect to the industry, and certainly we look forward to discussions with regard to our nursery operations and the kind of material that is developed, and look forward to other discussions in the future to help us with providing our state's seedling needs.
My understanding that Landon brings in its bareboot seedlings from Canada. Is that true, and how does that play into this?
Madam Chair, there are, yes, that is true. There are organizations that grow seedlings in Canada. Sometimes the seed is sent from Minnesota to Canada to be grown, and then the seedlings come back. Those are facilities in Canada that can grow seedlings to almost a custom designed quality, and so that is occurring, and that is something that we would hope that this study would help us identify, so that we here in Minnesota could also do that kind of work.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to correct the statement. I think you made the statement that Blandon brings its seedlings from Canada, but actually they're not bare root. The entire Blandon planting process is using container seedlings today, and that's much more popular in the industry today to use container, and DNR Nursery grows bare root seedlings. Blandon has transitioned, I think it was 15 years ago they closed their own nursery because they couldn't compete with the industry, and moved into private purchase, and they use all containers now. They don't plant any bare root.
But the reason I bring it up is if Blandon feels that it has to go to Canada, it seems that there is an assumption here. I mean, that there's a, if they're going to Canada now and not doing it in the United States, that there is something about the industry here that can't do it in the United States. So that just is an interesting question. We don't have to answer it. It's just something I've been thinking about.
Madam Chair, if I could, to that point, Blandon does buy within the state and does buy within the United States. Unfortunately, the PRT nursery that they buy from in Canada had government support from Canada at the beginning, and it makes it for an uncompetitive and unfair advantage for our people in Minnesota to compete on a fair basis.
Well, if that's the case, then we're going to, unless we change our relationship with Canada, that is going to remain. Any other questions here? Would you like to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to forest health, our forest management heritage, excuse me, Madam Chair, the recommendations to the public and private landowners of, in the management of forest pests will help us to continue surveys on state forest land for invasive plants, and will help also to manage and develop guidelines for the control of these terrestrial invasives. It will help us implement risk reduction practices to minimize the anticipated effects of critters like the emerald ash borer and gypsy moth populations. And additional money from the heritage enhancement account will help prevent the introduction and spread of the invasive species by maintaining gypsy moth trapping, developing guidelines for combating emerald ash borer and invasive terrestrial plants, also identifying and monitoring invasive pathways, and helping to control invasive species in critical habitats. If there are no questions to that, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and then just to go to the, you have before you the rest of the programs in the core program support, but I'll move down to the SFRA implementation on the last page, which is to incorporate multiple perspectives in managing and using the protecting of Minnesota forests to achieve the state's economic, environmental, social goals. Madam Chair, the supporting programs that is developed through this is the development of our site-level guidelines and improvement, landscape plan implementation throughout the state, policy development and operations and research. An example of the indicators and targets of the work done through SFRA implementation, specifically through the Minnesota Forest Resource Council, are the application of forest management guidelines that help incorporate the best available science and access the impact of potential changes for the guidelines in managing our riparian forests. Some of the revisions to the some of the key context and the change item impact are revisions to the riparian forest management guidelines based on scientific review. These guidelines must be evaluated for economic impact before adoption, and training on new biomass harvest guidelines will ensure their wide application. The landscape plan implementation change item targets. There are a number of landscape plans that have been implemented, and the continuation of the implementation of six landscape plans in 18 of the opportunity areas. One of the outcomes that we have there is the Pinchot Institute for Conservation brought national recognition to our landscape program. It is well respected. And then finally, Madam Chair, the policy and development operations for research. There are a number of Minnesota Forest Resource Council meetings throughout the state. There are a number of research studies that have been conducted. The Resource Council holds six meetings throughout the year, and the council outcomes that we have there, we have selected four priority policy issues for 2009 and 2010, and have leveraged $150,000 of non-state funding for state study of forest parcelization. So it's a very important program, Madam Chair, and that completes the discussion on the spreadsheet.
Questions from members? Representative Joe.
comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Everly, back on Representative Scalzi's question about what was going to be happening with those additional resources, the way you talked about your core mission. Can you, for the committee, I know the answers to this question, but I think we need to talk, have a very short discussion on what happens to our resource, the trees, when they're not cut at near the optimal time, not offered for sale, not sold, and not cut within that window of time that the contract allows, and what it does to our statewide asset value.
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, specifically to that question, when we don't harvest trees when they are time to harvest, and given the nature of our forest and the demands on our forest, we run the risk of declining health of the forest in general, particularly of the stands of trees. When the health declines, they're more susceptible to things such as invasive disease, mortality, and the quality of those trees drop. And when the quality of those trees drop and they go to harvest, then those folks depended on the forest products that come from those lands. If the quality is not there, their costs go up in the processing of the raw material in order to make their product. When their costs go up and they have to put additional additives, for example, into the fiber, then they also will increase their discharges to both the air and the water quality, and that's increasing cost. So the idea to have healthy forests, healthy timber of quality makes sense all the way around from the stump through the user.
I don't see any other questions on forestry. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just you can see on the bottom of the sheet there, the summary, there is significant potential for impacts of this division to that FMIA reduction of $11.1 million. That $4 million Forest Management Operations General Fund will help offset that and keep those activities somewhat whole. And then the last two change items that we discussed also will help us move our forward toward activities forward for the future. With that, I'm going to bring up Colonel Conrad, and we'll talk about the enforcement budget. Begins on page 5 of the spreadsheet, or page 4, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. The enforcement division is an area that doesn't have any change items, which is a good thing and a bad thing. There's no general fund reductions, no other reductions at all, but there are no other new monies as well. So we will be maintaining our activities, or trying to maintain our activities, as there are increased costs that are not being compensated for, but we can touch on that as well. But with that, I'm going to have Colonel Conrad talk about the enforcement budget. You'll see at the top there the estimated FY 10-11 expenditures is $66.2 million. And we're going to talk about the objectives, supporting programs, and outcomes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, for the record, Chief Jim Conrad, Division of Enforcement. Our first section is on environmental protection. That covers about 7% of our proposed budget. And in that section, we protect natural resources through education and enforcement, including the Wetlands Conservation Act, Operation Bird's Eye View, water quality enforcement, and other environmental protection, including air quality, timber, solid waste, work on wildlife management areas, aquatic plants, and some fire enforcement. We expect to try to continue our efforts in those categories. We are expecting a general fund reduction in that category, so some of our efforts may be curtailed to some extent, but in the Wetlands Conservation Act and Operation Bird's Eye View, we certainly can expect to continue our current efforts in that and reach our current goals.
Excuse me for just a second. I thought there were no changes here, but you're expecting reduced activity. Help us out here.
Well, Madam Chair, the reality of things are that the costs of doing business have gone up over the past couple of years. We've seen significant increases in our fleet, which is a major portion of our budget, and also increases in personnel costs. due to contractual obligations. Because of that, with no increases in our budget, we have to absorb those costs, and in our case, that tends to translate into reduced activity levels.
Madam Chair, specifically, this category of costs that we kind of call enforcement legacy costs that deal with contractual obligations that have been unfunded. The increases are unfunded to the department. This deals with the employer contribution to pension costs. Legislative changes to 352B.02 increased employer contributions for pensions for FY10 and beyond. This about $500,000 per year above FY07 costs. In addition, health insurance for retirees. The officers do receive health insurance paid until the officer reaches Medicare age. These costs have been increasing approximately 12% per year. The increase from 08 to 09 was $90,000. And contracted severance cost increases beginning in 08. The amount paid per officer upon retirement is approximately $10,000. So this is a category of unfunded costs that add up to about $1.5 million for the biennium that we will not be receiving any increase for. That we need to manage within the division. That's what Chief Conrad was discussing. Now, we need to manage, though the budget remains the same, there will be reductions in activities to meet these unfunded legacy costs that we need to meet.
That begs the question, or asks the question of incurring costs that we cannot fund, that are unfunded. How is it that the agency has done that?
Madam Chair, specifically at this level, these are costs that are starting to ramp up for us right now. We're going to be managing it through vacancies, through attrition. We will be not filling some positions. We will be having vacancies within the division because of our inability to meet payroll costs because of it. It's something that we need to talk about within this committee and within other committees as well, where these costs actually generate from.
I think this is a substantial issue when there are costs that reduce service to our communities that were not put into the budget. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, are these costs, or what percentage of these costs are related to the personnel fallout after the NAWIA conference? I mean, you're talking about pension obligations. Are any of these relating to severance? Are these normal severance?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, none of these costs are related to any of that activity at all. These costs are related to statutory and contractual changes that have occurred within the contract negotiations with our officers, and it also covers all other police and peace officers. They are under the same contractual obligation. So it's much like a made for an AFSCME contract that as the contracts get 3% increases, we don't get funded for that as a department. These are contractual increases that were unfunded at the agency level. So it's costs that we have to absorb. Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. It is a concerning issue, one that we wanted to bring to the forefront, make sure people are understanding the impact, but one that we need to figure out as a department and as a state government, how do we fund these costs in general.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to take up on that the point about planning here, and I just if you share with me, and I think Director Meyer be the person to share this, but with your experience in the DNR, and I don't know how many years or decades you've been there, but we've had costs that have increased, inflation, if you will, over the number of decades. Is that's your experience?
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, certainly costs at every level increase as the contracts continue to, the cost of living increases for everything. So the cost that we see, some of the uncontrolled costs that we've seen in the past couple of years, fuel costs have certainly changed and driven up our activities, but also the contractual obligations that we're required to meet, and the health insurance costs. It's the same thing across all levels of state government. But it's a little bit more impacting for us, especially at the fuel level and the fleet level on the past biennium, was really difficult when fuel was $4 a gallon, for example.
And, thank you. I'll tell you that's the response that I expected that you would say. And I guess I'm going to reinforce the point here that we've heard a lot in the recent history anyway, that we don't need to plan for this in our budgeting as a state government. Let's leave inflation, the cost increase that we expect out of the budgeting process. And I just want to point to the ridiculousness of this. And we're talking about reducing protecting our environment because we don't plan for these things. Doesn't make any sense.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I assume I know the answer to this. On the health insurance, you were talking about the health insurance increases, Commissioner Meyer, 12% for the retirees. Are they in the state employee group insurance plan? Or what insurance plan are they in? And the reason I ask that is because I have been getting some information from them, and the increases have been in terms of the state employees at the legislature, and many asked me, and many of the groups are in are very, very low in the last 3 years.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, are you referring upon retirement?
Uh-huh. You said the retiree cost, Madam Chair, that the retiree cost of insurance had escalated at about 12%, if I think I heard you right, in the last year alone. And yet that would, if they're in the CGIP, that would seem not in correlation with the information that I've been receiving. So that was my question, really. Are they in the state employee group health insurance plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I believe so. I need to just confer with that, but that is the indication I'm getting at this point in time.
Representative Dill, are you asking the question, do all state employees have health insurance after they retire? Is that what you're trying to get at?
Well, that's another question, Madam Chair. That's a good question about getting all the way to a Medicare age after they retire. And frankly, in just thinking about my staff person that's upstairs right now, she retired, and now she's back working again because she had to be paying her health insurance costs, and so she came back. So I just from that, it would seem that not all state employees get health insurance until they reach retirement age.
Well, I think you're right about that. So we have some employees that get health insurance and some that don't. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. And it is because of the law enforcement activities and the risks that they do take in their job every day. The legislature has determined that that is a benefit that they do receive.
Well, Madam Chair, that wasn't my original question, but I certainly understand your thinking on that.
Okay. Oh, yes, Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is pretty disappointing to hear that you've chosen to separate enforcement from all of the other functions that the department provides. All the other personnel issues, all the other equipment issues, and you're focusing on the cost of personnel and equipment in this section and not in the other section. And I'm just concerned, Mr. Meyer, that, you know, we've made great progress in enforcement and public education and protection of resources. And I can tell you, I see it every day, and I just, I'm not admonishing anybody or anything, but I think that the department needs to rethink this strategy here, because obviously to the public, the agency is de-emphasizing the importance of enforcement, and that's a signal to the public that I think is a concern. So I'd encourage you down the road a bit to be creative and figure out better ways of doing this.
So if you could give us that number again, you are decreasing your level of activity. I guess I'm saying hours of boots on the ground, maybe a way of putting it, by How much money and how many hours? Is that getting to your question, Representative Anzel?
Pardon me.
Oh, I was just checking to see if that was getting to your question.
Oh, yes. Perfect.
Madam Chair, in response to that, yes, we have a certain amount of operating expenses. Basically, our largest expenditures are salary and fleet, which is our trucks, our snowmobiles, our ATVs, that sort of thing, the things that we ride around on when we're doing our job.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two biggest costs. They amount to nearly 80% of our budget. When those costs go up, they definitely affect our operation ability. Currently, we have 17 vacancies in our organization. Of those, 11 are field officer stations. With that reduced number of people, obviously there's a reduced number of hours of service that we can provide. Current budgetary constraints, and if we see a flat level of funding for the next biennium, we do have to absorb those, and those stations will remain open, as well as possibly another 7 to 11 vacancies that will occur in the next biennium. Our service that we give to these various different categories are determined in hours of time spent on those activities. And it costs so much per hour of service when you consider not only the salaries but all the support that is given to it. So, yes, it's directly affected. The amount of money that we have, we try to convert into hours of service in whatever category that the funding came from and be cognizant of that relationship. We want to give money in game and fish, depending on the amount of game and fish fund dollars that we receive. So we try to be true to the funding source.
I think that the question, I think maybe you don't have the numbers here, but let's do the numbers and get it to the committee. How much, because of increased costs, let's know that number, how many hours are being reduced in the various activities, because we can observe that you're reducing efforts kind of down the line. So how many hours are you reducing in total? So, and what's the cost of those hours? And then the other question I would have, are you in your calculation of cost doing, is this all straight time or is part of it overtime?
Madam Chair, we are looking at straight hours of service. The overtime that is currently expended is restricted to certain activities. In other words, we don't allow our officers to charge overtime for repair work on their vehicle or something like that.
No, I think my question is more centered on, is there overtime built into this budget or not?
Madam Chair, yes, there is right now. However, depending on how many vacancies we have, what our funding is, those hours are either reduced or maximized depending on what kind of money we have. And that is one of the discussions that I've been having with my management team as far as next year, will we be able to afford the amount of overtime that has historically been given to our officers?
I would like to know how much overtime is budgeted into this spreadsheet, because I can't see it from here, if that's okay.
Madam Chair, we'll try to get that together for you and get it back. Just following up on your earlier question, the percentage of reduction in services, conservatively we looked at those fleet increases and salary increases and other things, and conservatively threw a 10% value to that, and the hours in this presentation indicate a 10% reduction in service across the board in those areas where we have seen static funding provided.
Okay. Can you just give us those numbers? Representative Steele.
Well, mine isn't on the exact subject that you have, but one of the things that I'd like to know is about deer baiting and how much expenditures are made trying to catch deer baiters with helicopters and airplanes. I'd like to have that information at some time. And also, when that's being done, is that also being charged out? Is there any overtime involved in that one?
Madam Chair, Representative, we'll get those numbers for you.
Thank you.
Members, other questions here? You want to continue?
Madam Chair, the second category is fisheries and game protection. That's approximately 61% of our budget. That is where the meat of our operation is, and that involves providing law enforcement for both fisheries and wildlife. In providing that, we work closely with the Division of Fish and Game to find out what their priorities are and to do our work planning in conjunction with their recommendations. It's a service that we provide for those hours. Also built into that is the firearm safety training program. Our goals are to continue that and maintain the numbers of the youth that are trained in those programs. Currently, approximately 24,000 people are trained each year through those programs. We will move for some cost savings there by going towards a web-based program to provide some of those services. We are already there, but we intend to expand that as well. Moving on to Section 3, Water Recreation. That's our boat and water enforcement efforts. That's about 13% of our budget, and that includes some pass-through grants to local law enforcement for increased enforcement work in counties across the state. Our intent there is to provide hours of service as well as through those hours of enforcement service to keep the deaths per 100,000 vote registrations beneath 5.3. I believe in our last presentation on outcomes for the 08-09 budget, we indicated that that was at a record low, and we like to take a little bit of the responsibility for that statistic. Next,
That is a good statistic, and good for you for that. And that is an outcome that defines what you really do. I look in some of these other categories, and the outcome is the number of hours on the ground. That is not an outcome. So we're going to have to help work with you to actually say what your outcomes are for the resource, because that's really what the outcome is, how the resource is protected. So we need some work here.
Madam Chair, I think we've had a little bit of that discussion before. We'd like to be able to provide you with reduced violation rates, those sort of statistics, and that would ideally be what we would like to do. However, we are not capable of doing that at this time, but we will work towards that. Our next section is public safety and service. That is a very small percent of our, only 2% of our budget, but it's very important. In many cases, our officers are on the ground and on the scene to various different public safety events. In the past, we've been first on the scene on numerous different occasions, including weather-related events, the 35W bridge collapse. Most recently, an officer shooting up in Manoman. We had four officers on the scene immediately and providing backup to the local law enforcement there. That small little bit of our duties are a very big part of our contribution to the public safety of the people of the state of Minnesota, and we expect to continue that. Also, in part of those duties is nuisance animal control and work.
We intend to reduce those efforts in order to compensate for the funding, and we will address those complaints through the use of public information and referral to private industry. Any questions on that? And our final category is recreational enforcement and safety training and education. This revolves around our ATV, snowmobile, OHM, and ORV enforcement and training. This represents about 17% of our budget, and also includes some enforcement that is directed towards non-motorized trail and recreation uses, such as the state trail systems, state parks enforcement, and state forestry recreational areas. We find this to be a growing section of our responsibilities, in that ATV use and interactions with other recreational users is increasing. We have seen some increased funding from that section that has supplanted some of our efforts other places. In other words, we have seen more work in the ATV enforcement realm, and we think that we are making some inroads on resolving some of the conflicts that are occurring out there through the work of our officers, and also through cooperative work with groups like ATVAM and the beginning of a program of ATV ambassadors, which brings some of the actual users, the ATV users, into the enforcement and monitoring of various different areas of high activity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is regarding the 17% of the budget, and we say 14,000 hours of ATV enforcement and 9,000 hours of snowmobile, etc. For instance, that 14,000 hours of ATV enforcement, what might that cost the taxpayer?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd have to do some quick calculations here. Currently, the hourly rate for an officer in the field with all support is about $140 an hour. So if we did the math, I guess we could come out with that number.
Mr. Chair, and is there another way to recoup some of those costs? Because I'm just trying to recall some of the figures that we heard before of the amount of people who use ATVs, the amount of people who use snowmobiles, and the largest use of our trails, etc., was walking and biking. And I'm wondering if there's any need for enforcement for those types of people. Do you do any enforcement for people who are walking and bicycling? Like this type of enforcement?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that would be the non-motorized enforcement that I referred to a little bit earlier. The money to do the ATV enforcement are from dedicated natural resource funds that are derived from registration and fees for trail stickers and that sort of thing. So it is a it is a program that the money comes out of dedicated funds.
Representative Shields, did you have a follow-up on that?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And my radar went up almost instantly. I'm sure, Madam Chair, you knew that my radar instantly got activated. So I want to actually reverse where Representative Scalzi was going on her question. The ATVs pay their own way. The snowmobiles pay their own way from our dedicated accounts, from our underrefunded gas tax and our registration. But who doesn't pay their own ways are the bikers and hikers, and those are the taxpayers that are out there. So I'm trying to reverse your line of thinking, because I think you were headed towards trying to say that we had 14,000 hours of enforcement and costing the general taxpayer. But the true cost of the general taxpayer is actually the hiker and the biker. So I'm glad you brought it up. I'm glad we could clarify that here today on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair, very much for this opportunity. And you know, Madam Chair, the legislature is a world of opportunity from time to time.
We are not going to get into that debate. I was thinking about what I should say, and then I thought, no, it's 7 of 10. We're going to end at 10. We're not going to end at 10:30. So,
Madam Chair, maybe we should talk about minutes.
11.
Madam Chair, that does bring us to the conclusion of the enforcement division's budget, and it is a great way to end, because it is important to realize that the division of enforcement budget is driven by the funding sources of activity that the department appropriates to that division. You can see the governor's budget for FY 10 and 11 is $66.2 million. Of that, 86% is from the Game and Fish Fund or the Natural Resources Fund, which comes from the user pay, the fishing licenses, the hunting license, the ATV, the snowmobile, off-road vehicle, off-road motorcycle fees that are out there. There's $6.2 million in the general fund that we were able to maintain. We did not have a reduction on that. And actually, Madam Chair, if you look at the presentations that we provided you, for the 08-09 budget, the department's budget was actually $65.9 million. So this does represent a small increase in funding, but we were not able to get any increases for some of those salary supplements that we talked about. So it is important to realize that we are doing all we can to maintain our enforcement division. In the significant times of pressure, we're looking at ways to realign our staffing alignment out there. We will discuss that in our comments back to you. Looking at ways to reduce costs through communication, internet connectivity, vehicle maintenance, what they own and operate, our fleet services that they provide. There's a lot of opportunity for us to reduce our expenditures at that level to increase their activities in the field. So we are taking that as a very serious look at an opportunity to get more people in the field to do the enforcement activities we need.
Well, we would like to have those numbers. I mean, it's getting close to time that we have to put our budget out, so if we could have those numbers early next week, it would be appreciated. Any other questions? Representative Hanson.
I have a question, but not on this subject. So
go ahead.
And it's actually on a bonding question. So.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, and I do have Mr. Harnack is here, and we had talked earlier about RIM dollars, and there's been questions discussed about supplements or supplants relating to some of the constitutional funds, and we've had a history of doing bonding for reinvest in Minnesota and for some dam projects and wildlife management areas, and Mr. Harnack has some information about some federal dollars for shovel-ready projects that may require some state match through RIM. So he could, I don't know where he went. So
let me just clarify for one thing. Yes, he could definitely come up. But Mr. Meyer, or Deputy Commissioner Meyer, do you still have the operations part to go through, or
yes, Madam Chair, we do have that one division to go through.
That shouldn't take long, but we will do that on Monday, if that's
Monday or Tuesday.
Tuesday, I mean, if that's okay, and we will have a long day Tuesday, members, very long day. Prepare for dinner. but I think Representative Hanson does bring up a good question that we should have a few minutes discussion on. Mr. Harnack, Representative Hanson had a question for you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Harnack, we had presented a bill earlier about for $5 million in reinvest in Minnesota, looking at the partnership that we had with the federal government last year on getting wetland reserve dollars for shovel-ready projects. We had testimony about the job creation involved in that, and you and I had discussed that there was some federal money, emergency watershed protection, that also requires RIM dollars for shovel-ready projects. We only have a minute. If you could just say what's there right now and the opportunity that we may have.
Madam Chair, Ron Harnack with the Red River Watershed Management Board. Yes, we understand from the stimulus package, the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, has about $10 million that Minnesota would have available for EWP, which is the Emergency Watershed Program, and it is only for acquisition of flood-prone easements. It's very similar to the WRP program in terms of its payment rates, and we would need to have additional dollars to leverage that $10 million to make the program competitive, because that program really doesn't pay the going rate of current farmland prices that's in the similar package as WRP is.
Let me ask you, when you say $10 million that we are eligible for, does that mean, is that solely Minnesota, or nationally there's $10 million and we could compete for it?
My understanding, Madam Chair, is that $10 million is Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Madam Chair, in the flood-prone protection areas, so that would be when there's the purchase of the easement, there's also restoration involved and getting land seeding and those type of things involved with local contractors.
Yes, correct? Madam Chair, Representative Hanson. Yes, it involves seeding and native vegetation as well as the contract aspects that go along with that.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, and I think the deferred maintenance is very important because it's shovel-ready and we have a backlog of work. But I think we've talked as a legislature generally that we don't want to let federal dollars that can provide jobs go back to the federal government. And so also that we've had a traditionally provided some RIM dollars that are there, and I'm aware that the Senate has not provided any RIM dollars. So it might be an opportunity to consider when bonding gets forwarded.
As we go without objection then from members, I will add that to the transmittal letter from this committee that this would be an opportunity that Minnesota should not forego. Any objections to that? I see no objections, and I will add that to the letter. Representative Purcell is going to move the minutes of...
Move the minutes of March 10, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. All those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Adopted. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Prepare for a long day on 50.